Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today from a blissfully dry but still overcast Vancouver afternoon. I'm going to have the pleasure today of speaking with Mike Gottlieb, who is sitting partway across our continent in Chicago. Mike is the director of emergency ultrasound at the Rush University Medical Center, and he and his colleagues have a paper coming out in the February 2020 issue of Medical Education entitled Imposter Syndrome Among Physicians and Physicians in Training, a Scoping Review. Thanks, Mike, for making the time to talk.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm excited to have you on, actually, because this is a topic that seems to be coming up more often of late. I'm seeing a number of people writing about and worrying about imposter syndrome. It seems like a natural follow-on to many of the wellness issues that have been raised over the last many years. But maybe I can start by asking you really the most basic question of all, which is, what is imposter syndrome, or what makes it different from just a general uncertainty about whether or not somebody's up to a particular task?
So I like to think of imposter syndrome as a spectrum. And there are definitely several different criteria you can utilize to quantify the degree of imposter syndrome. But what we've seen is that it often is the degree to which you feel fraudulent in a specific situation. And so that can impact people in a number of different ways. So some people will visualize this perceived in, fraudulence and almost freeze, as if you imagine like a fight or flight response. And they just completely stand still. And it can impact them to a degree to which they can't excel professionally, to which it impacts their personal well-being. There is ties to burnout, even to suicide related to this. And then we have another spectrum, the people who see this and they get almost the sympathetic surge of the fight or flight. It almost empowers them to work harder and work harder than their peers because they see themselves as not as successful or not as deserving as their peers. And so we see this kind of double-edged sword of this. And so when we look at imposter syndrome, it's this feeling of fraudulence, and it's also how people react to this degree.
That sounds like an important component, because I imagine everybody feels fraudulent to some degree, but what I'm hearing you describe is that it's as much about the reaction that causes as opposed to simply the feeling of uncertainty that one's able to do what is expected of them.
Exactly. It's the degree and the reaction that people have is a pretty strong component of this, because there's almost a separation between imposterism where there's progressive degrees of this. So when you look at these studies, there's often different scales that exist because it's not an on-off switch. It's not a yes or no. We can dichotomize it by using certain numbers, and several of these scales have numbers that are used to say, yeah, this is imposter syndrome or not, but it's a scale. And so if we take away the dichotomization, if we take, for example, the Clancy imposter scale, which uses a number typically of 62, if I'm 60 by, a straight yes or no, I'd be no, I don't have imposter syndrome, but I'm 2 points away from that, right? I have imposterism. So there's some degree of, to which it, you can have borderline. There's people who can be a 62 or can be upwards of 80. And they're, again, they're different levels of imposter syndrome. So while it is often treated as kind of a dichotomous yes, no, there's a lot of degrees in there, and there's a lot of components of how people respond to it.
Well, and as director of emergency ultrasound, there's not an obvious link between the measurement devices that you're using in your clinical practice and these imposter syndrome measurements. How does one who's so focused clinically on ultrasound become interested in imposter syndrome?
That's a great question, and it's funny because looking at it from the outside, ultrasound and imposter syndrome, there isn't a clear obvious link, much more than you would see in someone who works within medical education and works with learners. But I think the first impetus was just, as most good studies are, just reflecting on myself and a lot of the feelings of imposter syndrome that permeated through a lot of my training. Mm. And just reflecting back on, a lot of my peers and people who are, ahead of me, who I aspired to be, and feeling like, why am I here amongst all these other people? What is my reason? Why am I deserving of this? And it was something that impacted me for a lot of my career in terms of how I approach things. Hmm. I think I was fortunate that for me, a lot of that stemmed towards the push me to work harder and to continue to try to read more, learn more, and excel. But there's also times that it put a lot more stress than it probably needed to. And now looking at it from the other side with a residency program, we see this a lot amongst our residents. And I've seen this, you know, across programs, not unique to us, where we know the prevalence is quite high. And we know that this impacts everyone to varying degrees. And it's something that I think the onus, just like wellness initiatives, is not just on the wellness experts. It's on everyone to really step up to the challenge and help to address these, bring it to the light, and try to help people to feel comfortable to discuss it, address it, and hopefully to improve ourselves as a specialty.
Yeah, well, let me thank you right from the outset for taking that on, given the importance and the awareness raising as much as anything. What was it that led you to believe that a scoping review was necessary at this stage? It sounds, even from your introduction, as though a lot is known about this. What made you uncertain as to whether or not we had a full picture of how imposter syndrome might be impacting upon our education system?
Yeah, so a lot of my external research to this is within the realm of systematic reviews and meta-analyses. So I had a pretty good background in that, but I didn't have a lot in scoping reviews. And so, like anything, I spent a bunch of time reading through the core literature, reading examples of priors to get a sense of what this entailed. And as we approached imposter syndrome, as we were looking at this as a question, and we are part of actually a study group, which now is a great time to credit this amazing team that I'm a part of. So my team was Arlene Chung, Nicole Battaglioli, Stephanie Seabrook-Dyer, and A.K. Colin-Terry. And so the four of us, along with several other collaborators, were looking to study imposter syndrome. One of the first things we discovered is that there is information out there, but it's not well summarized. And so when we're looking at the literature, typically when we're looking at scoping review, we're trying to answer a few questions. And the first one is, what is the available literature out there? What is actually out there? Because if we don't have a great summary of this to see what's out there, it's hard to make informed discussions on future directions for study. So we wanted to get a sense of actually what the literature out there, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit later about the breakdowns of the study questions we attempted to assess. The second piece is, as someone who does systematic reviews, generally before doing a systematic review, you have to find out if there's enough data to actually do this, the value inherent in this. Because we could undertake a systematic review on a specific intervention for imposter syndrome and find out there's nothing out there. And it was much more valuable to see if there's actually enough information out there. So it provides information for us to determine future directions for studies. And most importantly, for something as big as this, to help derive ideas for future studies and help inform the literature going forward. So that was our goal with this first scoping review, is to just summarize what data is out there to determine if it was warranted to do a systematic review with a more meta-analytic component to it, and then to hopefully inform some future studies so we can continue to advance this field.
Well, and that latter phrase, continue to advance this field, I think is one of the things that I would highlight as being a priority for any review effort, certainly in terms of the niche that medical education is trying to fill. Oftentimes people get into these sorts of projects and they just wind up describing or annotating a list of papers that they came across, as opposed to using the effort of synthesis to generate new insights. Can I therefore ask you to share with our listeners, given the literature as you found it, what questions seemed able to be dug into a little bit more deeply, and what insights were you able to gain as a result of going through this effort at synthesis?
Sure. So for the study itself, we really sought to identify four main questions. And the first one being, what is the prevalence of imposter syndrome? And we specifically for this study looked at physicians and physicians in training, because this is a relatively unique population. So there is imposter syndrome data from other fields. There's a lot from the business and managerial world. There's some in the nursing literature, but there really wasn't as much among physicians and physicians in training, which is a relatively unique cohort, both with regards to personality trait components as well as just the nature of the training itself. And so we wanted to look at that. We wanted to see what the prevalence was. We wanted to determine if there's factors that contribute to this. So what is leading to this? And along the same side, what is a protecting factor? What can potentially be used to protect against imposter syndrome? And then finally, we wanted to see if there was a correlation between imposter syndrome and burnout. That was something that we suspected to be true, and we had seen a few small articles on this, and we wanted to delve further and really understand the literature and see how strong that correlation was or if it was reliably present.
And any surprises in there? We obviously won't have enough time to go into all the details, but what did you take away that you thought was most informative for the other work that you're trying to do?
So I think it was just kind of summarizing up for each of the questions, the main take-home points I had for this is that the prevalence is fairly high. on average, our study showed it was about 22 to 60% prevalence, depending on the populations. So it's not insignificant. If you looked around the room, in a room of five people, a minimum of one, if not three people, are battling imposter syndrome. And not just imposterism, but actually diagnosed imposter syndrome with a threshold above typically a CIPS of 62. So it's highly prevalent. We were seeing that there are some factors that help and some factors that are more harmful. And while the data definitely could be stronger, I think from a more practical standpoint, while there's a need for further study on these, just being cognizant of some of these components. And so unconscious bias is a significant component. We know that the majority of the studies demonstrated that there was a significant gender disparity in imposter syndrome with a much greater rate among female physicians. And there are a number of hypothesized causes for this. But I think the bigger thing is to look into this both to figure out what are the associated causes for this, how do we address this, and as a field in this unconscious bias, how do we combat the increasing rate of imposter syndrome to help kind of empower this? Along those lines, there's also components of things that are protective. So being able to talk to other people, being able to have this ability to normalize and speak openly and freely about this and not have it so stigmatized, which I think is tough in medicine, where it's often a culture that people don't feel as comfortable admitting faults and admitting errors. And I think being able to kind of address this component and normalize some of these challenges is really important. A lot of the literature has talked about the idea of having, you know, your networks, having mentors and colleagues, people who have gone through it, people who have been ahead in their career and can help to guide you through this process. And then the last thing is that there is a correlation between imposter syndrome and burnout. And this helped, I think, the next steps from there is to figure out how do we break that correlation? How do we help to lower and raise imposter syndrome? But if they are facing that, how do we help to prevent the impact on burnout, which is definitely something that's a significant issue in our field.
It's very interesting to me for a number of reasons, one of which is that there's been a heavy effort put towards trying to better understand the limitations of self-assessment, often driven by the concern that people are overconfident and maybe putting patient safety risk because they're doing things or believe they're capable of doing things that in fact they're not quite ready for. This to me sounds like it's sort of the opposite corner of the 2x2 table, where really the issues that you're trying to help us grapple with are those cases where people actually should feel more empowered to move forward, but may become paralyzed, as you said, because of feelings of imposter syndrome. And it feels like a constant effort at balancing if you're trying to support these individuals, making sure that you're offering some of those personal protective factors, the affirmation, the social support, without misleading people in terms of you being better than they actually are. I wonder if I can just ask you to share your current thoughts on how do you walk that line, recognizing that things can go off kilter in multiple directions.
That's a great question and a major point. I think there's probably two components of that double-sided coin, if you will, of the imposter syndrome versus overconfidence and sitting on the wrong side of Dunning-Kruger, wherein there's potentially some degrees of, if you're feeling greater sensations of imposter syndrome, or you have a greater degree of imposter syndrome at a given time, you may be kind of overcompensating and more blind to feedback, which will then present externally as overconfidence, but in reality, it's trying to salvage the limited confidence that you may feel at that time. So I wonder to some degree whether it's not so much overconfidence as in trying to just maintain their confidence, and as such, being less receptive to the feedback and the changes that are so crucial to actually improving. And so by addressing this both on an individual scale and, you know, talking it through with the person, a lot of times when I do feedback with the residents after a shift, we spend, you know, 10, 15 minutes, we go aside, we talk it through, and we kind of normalize the feedback is normal, that's how we improve, and trying to normalize, you know, we all learn along the process, and that we should be getting feedback and changing because that's the purpose of us being here. I think the other component of that is from an institutional standpoint that we need to address and normalize cultures of that we make mistakes and we make errors, and that's okay as long as we learn from it and we address it appropriately. And I think when we normalize that we're human beings and we can make errors and we should always be pushing ourselves to improve no matter how many years of practice we are, it should hopefully allow more receptivity to that feedback and less appearance of overconfidence.
That's very interesting. And again, just another reminder about just how complex some of these things can be and how easy it could be to draw an inference that maybe doesn't actually reflect the specifics of the individual situation, which I think is actually a really good place for us to wrap up on. This is a really important paper, as I said to you before we even started recording, I think, in terms of creating a touchstones for us to start thinking more deliberately about imposter syndrome. And I want to thank you for putting it together and for the work that you and your colleagues did. And I'm sure I speak for everyone I say we'll look forward to seeing how this continues to evolve. For those who are listening and need a reminder of what we've been talking about, the voice you've been hearing is Mike Gottlieb, and he and his co-authors have a paper entitled Imposter Syndrome Among Physicians and Physicians in Training, a Scoping Review, that you can find in the February 2020 issue of Medical Education.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak about this. As we discussed as well, I think it's such an important topic, and I appreciate the opportunity to have the dialogue about it and to help to open this up and lead to hopefully a number of future studies as well.